This is CliffCentral.com.
Simon and Nonke, welcome to the show. It's another hour of Frankly Speaking. Dumelang Roysang Shabalala.
Andrew Leve.
How are you, man?
I'm good. Dearing.
I'm right. I'm fine. I'm interested by what's happening in this conversation today. Like, I have no idea where we're going today.
That's good. That's every now and then it helps to be lost.
You think so?
Yeah.
Yo, I don't know, man. I'm worried. We've got two very, very cool people in the studio, both freaking rad, and you've got some ideas, and I have no idea. So tell me.
Yeah. So you know, it's Nelson Mandela Day season. It was Nelson Mandela Day yesterday. And we thought, you know what? Let's take a look at this theme from a different angle. And one of those themes, if you remember Nelson Mandela's speech on the Rivonia trial speech, he said, "I fought against white domination, fought against black domination." And I think the big thing that we wanted to look at is how have things changed since the time that he made that speech, since 1994? How have things changed? And we zoomed in as we were having conversation on a particular subset of people who we felt were bucking the trend, who seemed to have probably gone further than the rest of us in terms of making that Mandela ideal come true. And these are people who occupy spaces that were traditionally, historically set aside for people of a certain skin color. So in this instance, we're speaking to two amazing men who did not only find themselves with as white men in black spaces or whatever was supposed to be black spaces, but decided to stay there even beyond the time where they had the choice to move out. But even beyond just occupying black spaces, I think there are many white people that happily go into black communities and so on, but they normally go in as the khrutbas.
Token white guy.
They go in as the khrutbas, but these are the white guys who have gone in and almost embraced black culture, if there's such a thing, and have embraced it so well that it actually leads to a question about what is black culture, what is white culture, or what does it mean just to be a South African? And what we see in these guys is, for me, I think, a reflection of what it might mean to be a South African when it becomes immaterial, what the color of your skin is, and you simply embrace a culture of being that is suited to the type of person that you feel you are.
Very interesting. If you want to join the conversation, you can hit us up on WeChat at Cliff Central or on Twitter at Yebo_Levy or at Rory Shabalala. And yeah, we'd love to hear from you and hear what you think about these guests in studio today. I'm very excited to have two very, very cool guys. Gavin Hunt, eh? I mean, how many times do you have to let a guy win before he coaches Pirates or Chiefs? Eh? Like, I just want to know, like, what's the vibe there?
You know you're awesome when you're like, I'm gonna win. With these teams that you think there's nothing that can be done with them, I'm gonna win.
MTN 8 PSL season 2016-17 Coach of the Year. He joins the club. How do you say this? The exclusive club of being a coach that has won 4 titles. Is it 4 now, Gavin?
Yep.
Yeah, it is, right? Matatanza twice?
3 times.
3 times, okay. And Vitz now once. Yes. And he, you know, Rory, I didn't know much about Gavin in terms of his own football playing career.
You were born there when I was playing.
Maybe there's a reason for that. But Gavin has literally lived soccer since day one, played for Hellenic, which is an old club down in Cape Town, I believe. And, you know, you would have been the next best thing, but then unfortunately that Achilles tendon disappeared, and that was the end of you. Look at me, I'm bringing all this like knowledge back. Eh?
Well,
look at
well.
That, eh?
People forget that people you forget used to be a sports announcer.
I used to be critical of this guy when he used to come out.
In my day, there was no television; it was just black and white rolling screens. You know,
Gavin, so good to have you. Thank you so much for joining us, man.
Thank you.
In the other corner, we have Pule Skotan. And sure. Now this guy needs no introduction, but maybe give a little introduction that we know of. Started out as a comedian, does band stuff, is flipping a musician, is a comedian, is a storyteller.
I started as a rapper, man.
Is that it?
Yeah, I started
before.
As a rap, yeah. Splash Jam, Dungeon Sack, 1808, all the hood shows. Yeah.
You don't know them. No, I know them. No, you don't. It was back in our time.
You know what Pule does? He makes you feel totally shit about your life, you know, because you're like, he'll be like, yeah, I started out, I did Shaq Jam, did this, and you're like, I don't know any of those things. Like, I'm just going to nod my head and agree. Okay.
No, those cool shows back in the day in the hood, like nice hip hop shows, proper stuff, when the hip hop culture was really, really strong. That's where we started. A lot of us comedians started like that. Jay Poogie is also from 185 to Midlands. And also Smokey Nyembe is from there. We all started out there. Started out as MCs at hip hop shows. I started out as a rapper. They started as literal MCs, you know, like literal MCs, not hip hop MCs. they were the hoster of the show.
The program director.
So you were the steering. And they were the hoster, right?
Yeah, I was the striker in the hip hop crew called Terway. I came for just scoring a goal. I was only there in the last 90 minutes.
It's a super sub. It's a super sub.
Look at this guy. He's taking over our show. So we got these two gentlemen in, and I think it's going to be an interesting conversation. I have no idea where we're going in terms of this, but I do think that I'm interested to hear your perspectives on life. Because I think they are very different, regardless of how you classify yourself. And Joe, maybe we can speak about that a little bit, because we're speaking off air about it. But about
mine? What are you doing?
No, you're not that. You're not this. You're not the
okay,
other.
Okay,
like, we'll talk about it. But I think it's interesting to see how, firstly, I suppose, Rory, fascinating that we even have to have this conversation in 2017 where there are still very black spaces and very white spaces, right?
Can I challenge?
Make yes, challenge. Challenge.
Can I say Mshengu, please? Can I say to you?
You know, it's the second week that they're calling me by my name. Remember the last guest?
Yeah.
This is nice.
Can I say please to you? Why don't you, as a challenge, try to do your intro that you did, nice intro that you did again. But try to do it without using racial terms. Try. Okay. As an exercise.
So, explain that. What racial terms?
No, try to not use any racial language. Mm-hmm. Try to explain what you want to say without. It's a challenge for you.
Mm-hmm.
It can go somewhere, but I'm just as a challenge.
All right, so let's try. So, today we're going to speak to two amazing men who have embraced all of South Africa. Right? They are... Most South Africans decide to live their lives behind the borders of, you know, self-imposed borders, psychological and historical borders that no longer hold us back from connecting across the different communities that we come from. They have decided to embrace 100% of the country, and we're keen to explore how it is that they have managed to make that leap and embracing cultures, embracing communities that you know, the rest of us wouldn't necessarily embrace. How did I do?
I think that was great.
What are you teaching us?
Now, what do you think, Joe?
You see, now he's playing mind games with me. He's killing me.
You know, he's part of a game show. He's a game show host now. This is the thing with this guy.
No, I mean, to me, that sounds much more interesting than what you said before. Like, how many times do I come and do an interview and people say your first intro? It becomes boring, Joe.
But
because,
it's
always the same thing, you know.
But it's boring for you because you experience it, but it is a reality that we still live with. And, has it not become boring to see the country as it is, where you have communities that are still divided according to race? It is boring indeed, but has it not gotten to a stage? And this is why we want to speak to guys like yourselves who have gotten so bored of it that you've decided to break the rules, the self-imposed rules, and go out and you know, explore. 60%
yeah.
60% of South Africans live in townships. To the extent that you stay, you decide that the only places that you really know is where you work, where you live, and where you go on holiday, you are depriving yourself of 60% of the population. And you guys have bucked that trend, and I think that's what we want to speak about.
Yeah, you know, it's not necessarily something active, you know. That thing is a passive thing. The fact of the matter is that those trends, that's what you're putting on. Mm-hmm. That's what's being imposed.
Exactly.
It's just existing, Joe. So
let's go.
The complexity of this country is much more than is spoken about in the media in English.
Mm.
There's a big problem is that we talk about these things in English.
So yes. Okay.
Why?
So kuluma isiZulu, okay. What is the issue?
Mawufuna ukuthi igama lesilungu elithi race ngesiZulu. Ngisibonela. Uzothini? I-race ngesiZulu.
Yeah.
No, ngiyakubuza.
Angazi.
Ngiyabona. Kufanele ushaye ama up and down, you know. Ngiyabona. Ngesilungu bathi circumlocution.
Joe McFire Alex.
Circumlocution.
Yes.
Kufanele explain uchaze kahle ngamagama amaningi. Kusho ukuthi i-race ngesilungu kusho ukuthini. Ngoba ngesiZulu akunagama elithi race. So thini? So thi yini? Uhlanga. Mara uhlanga akusiyo race. Doesn't translate.
But let me challenge you, Pule, because you have let's say gotten to a certain level of consciousness that most of us are not there yet, and it's probably unfair to impose a responsibility on you. But if we're going to see the South Africa that we all envisage, we almost need people like yourself to not simply I'm bored of this. You guys figure yourselves out. We actually need, that's why we have to ask you these questions and bore you, so you can help us understand what is it about you, what is it about your life that has led you to take this counterintuitive journey, so to speak.
Well, I mean, the thing is, come with something, you know. You can't come with like base one, level one things. You need to, there's levels to this issue.
You need to go
a bit deeper, you know. You need to like approach the thing as if like you want to find something you didn't expect. Because if we just go on expecting things, we're gonna see them, you know. I always say that, and I'll say it in a very high English right now. I'm gonna say it in a powerful English right now. I'm gonna say this thing. I would say this: ontology conditions phenomenology. Not vice versa. In other words, you don't believe what you see. You know? You see what you believe. If you believe something, you will see it. Can I give you an example?
Go ahead.
We were once working on this show, Mikasi Sukasi. It was a show I used to do on SBC 1. It's going to come back. It's a nice show. It's a travelogue. Go around different Kasis, checking the cool things with someone that's from there. Business, arts, all kinds of things. Nice show, yeah. And then our driver was a gent by the name of Upra Pikes. And the first time I saw Upra Pikes, I said, "Bengkulumisuli." And I thought, "Ngoba lomutlo like umnyama, umnyama, umnyama." He's very, very dark in complexion.
Why are you laughing? You see, that's another thing we must check. What you said wasn't funny, but you laughed. Why are you laughing?
No, it is funny. That's yourself.
What you said is this guy's dark.
No, I understood that. I got that.
So, and then obviously the way he responded, ngizulu kuthi umzulu phaqa.
Yeah.
You are born. Like, and I learned later on that umama akhe uphume eNyukasela and whatever. Yeah, vele umzulu phaqa. And we were doing this, we were going around with this person, ne? Because he was our driver, ne? And then we did one episode eventually where we were going to Elos. And then next thing, because we had only been talking ngesiZulu throughout, then we were going to Elos, and then next thing, Bra Pike starts talking in Afrikaans. In English. And I thought to myself, oh, Bra Pike is talking in a so-called colored accent. Then I said to myself, how lo muntu we colored? And then I saw myself, what I was thinking. I started looking at Bra Pike and looking at his face to find the colored. Where's the colored in Bra Pike?
Yes.
And I stopped myself and said,
Nyanzan.
Yeah. Amanga.
Yes.
I'm not next like that, Joe. Yes. There's nothing like that you're not going to find the colored in that person.
Yes.
There's no way you're going to see that race in that person.
To that,
that race is not true.
To that point, is your challenge to us that we're trying to find a white man in you, and you're like, there's no such thing.
Mm. Mm. There's a white man in all of us.
Mm.
That's what my friend Dean said. Mm. Learn to fuck the white in you. That's what he said.
Pule. So people are listening to this and are just like, what
they're like,
is
where
going
are
on?
We? Where
no, but
are we? Yeah.
Frankly
speaking,
no,
where
but
are we? Yeah.
Give us a sense of your story, Pule. How did a person with your skin color? So yes, not about what you identify as, but how did a person with your skin color end up living what is a non-traditional life for a person with your skin color?
You see, the thing
give us your history. Don't pontificate as yet. Give us the history, then you can pontificate.
No, but let me give you a history, for example. Some of my family live in a place called Hlutankungu. Now that place is between Eqopo and Emsindo and Natali, Okuini. You see, those people are the descendants of a certain gentleman by the name, well, I don't know if he was a gentleman, but
he was a man.
a guy.
Yeah. another out
called C.D. Stewart. Mm. And he was married to Umandisa Mkhize, the daughter of the Mkhize chief Mbanga Mavovo. So this is the left hand house of Mkhize, not Kabazele, but Mbangi. Because not a lot of people know that.
That there are two houses.
It's not a big one, you see. So there we were from Jolifet, around that area.
Mm.
That place is that Mkhize household, right? And those people who stayed there, they're all the descendants of C.D. Stewart, Nomandisa Mkhize, and a lot of other important households, like Abakwawohlo, which became the Pegani clan, the Steinbanks, you know, the Dance, or Chantoni, you know, and what we used to call, my great grandfather used to call the Syrians, is people that came from Syria. So in my family, right there, we under apartheid, we were classified in all of the racial groups.
Wow.
All of them.
Wow.
All of them.
So it was difficult having a family meeting.
There wasn't a family meeting. That's what apartheid did.
Exactly.
There wasn't a family meeting.
Yeah.
And to this day, the family others are racist.
Can you imagine? Yeah.
You see, but they're also not.
Mm.
It's complex. You see, because those everyone's Kurumizulu sonke.
Okay.
And others don't know English properly.
Mm.
But that's the thing. So you'll find a place like Hlutankungu. It was classified as a colored area. But that place, the people that my uncle, Uncle Gordon, like Washo, Gordon Washo. So the Washo is the Zuluization of Ogle.
Okay.
So you find a lot of people called Ogle. They're all Zulu. That's a Zulu. Mm. That's a Zulu surname. Mm. Ogle Washo.
Mm.
It became the Pegani clan under the Msomi, house.
Mm.
And all those. All those people there, they used to say that where we live here, we are smarties.
Mm.
You'll find every color.
Every color
you'll find.
Every spectrum, from pale to dark.
And that's a common thing in this country, actually. The problem is that it's not common where we are in our Rosebank, RBK, Kalani. Stand up. Rosebank, Kalani, RBK, stand up.
There's no one standing. And no one's going to admit to that.
Yeah, where we are now, nobody talks about that. Yeah, we've got to move on to the next case.
No, I think it's interesting. I mean, Gavin, you're sitting here. You've never been so quiet in your life, I'm sure, as a coach of many different teams.
Not much shocked.
How does like a story like this penetrate with you or sit with you in terms of what you've seen in your life? I mean, being a soccer player to soccer coach in South Africa, you know, Rory was speaking about lots of people don't support local soccer. Well, that's been your lifeblood, you know. A story like Pule's, how does that resonate with someone like you?
Well, it's very, you know, I come from a very small town called Simonstown. Now, if you blink, you miss it. it's a naval
Nuisance was from there. Just Nuisance. That's the dog.
That's
right. Yeah.
The dog there. And it's got a great history, and And you come from an environment where we never saw many people. I lived in a town where there must be 150 people. We knew everybody and everybody knew everybody. So you didn't... Obviously, as I started to play football, I started to move closer towards Cape Town. I moved up there. And then you started to interact with different races and things like that. So it was very, very difficult for me seeing, you know, what is this all about now, you know, as a kid growing up. And then as a 16, sort of 15, 16-year-old, that's when it really hit me that there's other people that live in this country. Because I never knew anything. I mean, that's how you lived there in the little town there. And then obviously playing football started to mix with other races. And that was interesting. I found it so interesting how we as South Africans, how we grew. Then what happened was then you had all the different leagues in South Africa, the Black League, the White League, the Indian League and all that. And then we all came together in about 78, 79. It was about 1979, yeah. So I only turned professional in 81. So when I was still playing in the Coloured League, this is the federation it was called. Then you had the Black League, which was Kaizer Chiefs, the Orlando Pirates. So we played 1 year there, then we all came into this one league. And I'll tell you an interesting story. We played the years, you know, it was, then you had sort of white clubs and black clubs, and then, you know, it was crazy. But it all sort of, about 83, 84, when the ANC and all that started to come about and all that. And we played in Witbank, and there was a necklace. And I've never seen a person being burnt alive in front of me, thrown petrol on and burnt alive. He was a black policeman who was informant for the white government. And we played playing Black Aces, and this guy, anyway, the gun went off, and they chased him through the stadium, and he got onto the field, the game was on, and he got through the barbed wire, and I've never, and you know, we, growing up, we never knew about ANC and what was going on, and then all of a sudden you heard, well, what is this ANC about, you know, and it's amazing how your life, you all of a sudden you become interested in it. I took a huge interest in what is this all about. Then we were forced to go to the army. As a white South African, we had to go to the army, and I was walking around with guns, and who were we fighting? I mean, didn't see anybody, but who were we fighting against? It was crazy, and you know, people think, oh, and you know, it was difficult. It was very difficult, and then to see somebody to see somebody standing in front of me, burning alive, who I couldn't do anything about. You know, it was crazy, crazy.
What was it like going to the army? Now you're playing in the coloured leagues, right? You're playing, and then you said that everyone came together. Now you have to go off to the army, and I mean, you're right. Who are we fighting against? You probably didn't see anyone, but
no, we didn't see anybody.
The apartheid government was probably quite hardcore in saying these are the enemies. This is what they look like. Their colour is.
It's like if you go back to Hitler and all the great leaders and all the great leaders. Don't say that. Leaders of the world, there was intimidation, indoctrination. And you get indoctrinated about fighting these people. Who are these people? Why? Well, but they're only just fighting for what we've got and what they, you know what I'm saying? So it was a strange time in a young boy, 16, 15, 16 year old, don't know too much about what's going on, and then finding out, obviously through football, because football was my in. Then I really got to know about this day. Then got to Soweto, and this is like the biggest area and township. And it was as a 17-year-old white boy playing in this area. It was usually what's the word, intimidating. But I found it that even with all that hatred and that, there was a friendliness amongst. There was a banter, if I call it like this English terminology, a banter. You found you got chatting to, and there was things that they liked that I liked. Which was music. And I always felt music was the greatest together.
Like together puller.
Yeah. You know?
Because
I still puller.
We're breaking it.
But, you know, the only thing I can't get is Kopo. I'm telling you that. When I saw that, I went, ah. Yeah, I try, but ish.
You can't have Kopo.
Yeah. So, you know, people got this whole thing, and he's just mentioned it about there shouldn't be, but there was that. It was crazy. And then you say, well, how do you handle it? Well, this is great. I'm music, and let's go, and this is how these people live, and I like this. You know what I mean? I've never had a problem with that type of thing.
How did you deal with the family back in Somerset West? Summerstown.
Well, I didn't have a family life. I was the only child. My parents got divorced when I was 9, 8 years old. So I didn't, I say it, it's not a very nice thing to say, but I don't really see my parents. I don't really know them that well, you know.
You didn't have anyone that was saying, are you crazy?
I was taken in by people who helped me, and, you know, and that's, and football was my, was
your saving grace in many ways.
It saved me. Well, jeez. It's also given me lots of, you know, heartache and joy, but certainly, you know, and then you sort of go from there, you know, but, it's crazy.
So, when you began to embrace, black culture, and I know Pule will pummel me for this, because it's probably not a conscious thing and so on. But
well, the biggest thing for me was the food. The food is the biggest difference.
Yes,
because we ate rice and they ate pap.
Yes.
What is this? I didn't understand it. I was years a boy of 17, 18. I've never seen pap in my life. And we ate rice. You know, like rice. This thing that sticks together, you throw it against a wall, it sticks against a wall, you know. And, you know, it was like, and so the food was the biggest thing, the difference in the food. The music was different. You know, people, they like that music, we like this music. And then eventually, like, I like that music. Cause and today, I'm hooked on.
I mean, you are now the hero of the dance moves these days. Eh?
So and you know, and in those days, we used to have clubs. If you want to call them non-black clubs, and we weren't allowed to go to them as white people, and I used to go because I used to play with the players, and they used to take me. So I got used to this. It wasn't goof 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 then. It was a little bit different, you know. It was more R&B, very R&B. R&B, and you know, Isaac Hayes and Isaac Hayes and then Luther Vandross and all that type of stuff came. But I mean,
the thing I find interesting about your story is at 17 you're very impressionable. So, how is it that, you know, serving for the apartheid army at the time that didn't change you?
Not at all. No.
How did you survive within?
Well, I was lucky because I played football, so they looked after me.
Okay.
You didn't have to do as much as the poor guys that went to the Angolan borders and stuff like that. And then you had the township patrols that we all had to do. You know, and so we did pretty much down in Cape Town, but there wasn't really much going on in those early 80s, you know. But, not at all. Didn't change my thought pattern or... I actually didn't have a thought process or a pattern. I was pretty innocent, like, what is this all about? And interesting to discover, you know, why and how, you know.
So, if you've just joined us, we're speaking to two incredible gentlemen with two very different stories, very different perspectives on life, and that's what's cool about this conversation, right? I don't even know where we're taking it. I hope you're following in some way or form. I'm not sure I'm following, but it's cool. Like, we just go with it and see where we come from. Guys, Pule, maybe start with you.
Yeah.
It's interesting. So, your background is very unique. In a way, I would say, to the rest of the country, which is really rad. Let's flip it. So we've been speaking about, oh, how do you feel in black spaces, guys? Like, well, you know, like, is that hectic for you? And you're like, well, you're saying, Pule, I don't feel that this is a black space. This is a space which you then occupy. And of course, Gavin, it is a very different space to where you grew up in Simonstown. Let's reverse it. When you engage in white spaces, how does that feel? Is it off? Is it different? Is it just another space, Pule? Is it a space you feel comfortable in? Gavin, you know, like...
For me, it's another space. I don't see it as a white space. Another Jabu has mentioned it. I mean...
Jabu. You are
Jabu
not Pule.
Jabu Pule.
Jabu.
A lot of people do that. People call me and say, hey, Jabu! I'm like, Pule. It's like Cockney rhyme and slang, you know?
Sorry,
apples and
sorry,
pears.
Sorry, Pule. I mean, if you look at... I mean, I think, you know... I mean, you know, people in South Africa go from positive to negative very quickly. Very quickly. But they take a long time to go from negative back to positive. That's crazy. That's crazy. And I'm positive. I think things are moving. I think things are better. I think there's much more. I mean, I enjoy going out in the space. In the space, if it's whatever, whatever you mentioned, colors. I don't see it as a color space. I see it as a space. You know, I'm quite comfortable going to a space that's not comfortable for me as a white man, if you want to call it. But then and going to a space where I possibly would be comfortable, if that's what you want to call it. I don't see it like that. I don't see it like that. I don't see it like that.
I feel like we're off before we hit Pule quickly. I feel like we're completely off here, Rory.
What do you mean?
I feel like we're getting attacked for this kind of concept, but I think this is a real concept, but it feels like you guys are like...
I actually am attacking you, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, it feels...
I actually, when he said...
Yeah, because the concept is whack, yo. You came with a whack concept. I'm sorry, but that was a concept that you head up with. It's weak.
Let me challenge you on that, because you're saying it, but it is a lived experience of the majority of South Africans. So... what is whack is the lived experience that we take this from, right? We didn't make this up. We didn't sit in a room, in an empty room, and come up with it. It is an observation of how South Africans live their life.
From a colonial perspective.
Exactly. So we need to understand
from a white perspective.
Exactly. But then we need to interrogate that. To say that it's whack and therefore let's ignore it, I think is wrong.
We shouldn't ignore it, but let me say that it's whack, first of all.
Yes. No, you're right. I don't disagree with you. I don't disagree with you. It is whack. How do we fix it is what I'm interested
in. Well, look, you talk about lived experience. I'll tell you my lived experience. I was thinking about it. It's good you asked the question, because like I've never been comfortable. I only grew up then realizing there's something like white space, and finally getting when I was older into a white space and looking what this looks. I've never been comfortable. I'm scared of whites. I never was comfortable in that space. I was always uncomfortable. I never grew up in that. I'm still getting to grips with what that means. And that's a common experience of many South Africans, I would imagine. It's just that a lot of people think, like, I have something where I can go in that space. But, like, maybe I have something more in that. If Uyang Pega, Umlung, if you don't know me. But the thing is, at the end of the day, I'm not familiar with that ish. I'm not familiar with any kind of white thing. I don't know that thing. I've never been there. When I'm growing up and going into these spaces, I'm still an outsider. I'm still a foreigner. I'm still not there. And that's a common experience in this country, to feel in the liminal space. And it's a common experience, especially for those who were classed so-called colored.
Yes.
That is the most othered category in this country. Because it's most of those people are Kwekwe people, Kwekwen and San people, mostly Tram, Tregui, even Tregui people, even Ng people, Homani people, all the people that we call San, we just give them this lump name San, and Kwekwe people, and Kwekwe people talking about Kora people, talking about Khiri people, also known as Khirikwa. We're talking about Namakwen, we're talking about Damakwen, and all of these people on apartheid, and even were in our ideologies today, we call these people colored, and it's my family as well. It's called coloreds, you know, and that's such a terrible racist term, this term that I don't agree with, and it's an othering term, you know.
Yeah, but Bule, which parts of this, you speak of a thing, you speak of, I don't identify with this thing. What parts of this thing are most jarring for you when you enter such spaces?
Well, the first is the language, you know, because I grew up speaking Zulu, Sotho, and English, but the English that we speak wasn't the one, the dialect, so, you know, the white so-called dialects, you know, as well. So there's so much miscommunication that happens, especially with friends, you know, friends who grew up in white space, that like I'm saying something and I just didn't know that idiom, you know, because I don't know that English. And that's a common thing with South Africans, you know, that we keep on having to go into a foreign space. And that's why I think, like, the kids now, in terms of Fees Must Fall and everything, what they're saying is this is our space and we must take it. Whereas we, when we were at varsity and stuff, we were like, this ain't our space. It's a white space. We're just going there to do what we need to do and bounce, you know? And like now the kids are like, nah, this is our space. It must look like what we want. It must represent us. So that's the change that's happened in this country. That's why it's important.
So when you say it is our space, it needs to represent us. What does us represent?
Africans,
what is your definition? What is your definition of a representation of us?
Well, to me, I'm looking for decoloniality, man. I'm looking for to decolonize in many respects. Like, so simple things like ulimi, one's the first and most important thing, because it's where the discourses are happening that are not represented. So we're talking about race with these big, we're talking about words, woke terminology like intersectionality, all these kind of things, English terms, like it's so difficult. How are you going to translate that? And yes, so we're forgetting that there is a long history, for instance, in Xhosa literature, the likes of Umkhai, you know, and the times of Khubusan and these people, and that they have written many things which are speaking about these complex issues. This is now in the 1910, 20, 30, 40s, you know. That time, there was a lot of high intellectual progress in Ngesintu. And in terms of literacy, and that kind of tradition we don't acknowledge today, and that tradition is something that is not mainstream, and the reason is because English is in the mainstream now, and when we keep thinking in English, we are ignoring isiNtu, we are ignoring indigenous culture. And when I say isiNtu, I'm also talking about Khoekhoe and San culture. I'm not only talking because they feed into each other.
Yeah. Gavin, the kids are referenced. You have, obviously, you've lived in Venda, you've got interesting stories about living in Venda and so on. How do you raise your kids? You say you don't identify as these spaces as white or black. If you had to look at your kids right now, you know, what culture do you think they embrace, and what drives, what is South African culture?
Well, because they've been lucky, they've been fortunate, they've been coming to the football stadiums, mixing, the schools have been mixed, so they've been lucky that they've got a South African culture, not
What does a South African culture look like?
Well, listen, the only thing that they do Zulu. That's my biggest regret, you know, that I should be talking the one of the languages.
How do you coach guys that don't speak English or aren't fluent in English?
Like Pule talks now. I've got a feel of where he is. You know what I'm saying? But I'm obviously not very fluent because I wasn't brought up in that as my home tongue, my home language. So it's natural. I mean, any kid gets brought up your home tongue. But I mean, I feel we should be embracing the language more, and I think language will break a lot of areas. If you want to call it down or whatever, I don't know if that's the terminology. Maybe that's the wrong terminology. But I think language in South Africa will help
break the barrier.
I wouldn't say no. Let's not go break. Interact with people more. Language, and I think it's the biggest. And I think that's something that needs to certainly be embraced a bit more, and people need to be talking the languages.
And all those languages that are not official as well. You know, we're talking about Siputi, we're talking about Sipaka, Sihlubi, Sipulana,
but does that come from more areas maybe?
Yeah.
Is that where their languages
are
strong?
Those are so important, those things, because I wish I could have been marginalized. And that's the real story of South Africa, is those things.
Sure.
Khwekhwe Guvap, Muki. You know, when I say something like Khutse Hui Ida Kauba Sida Umisa, that's the original language of this kind of place. This is
But Pule, let's. A lot of people are sitting here saying, I mean, it's fantastic. He speaks of this ideal. We can't relate. So where does a person who isn't at that level of consciousness that you're at start? Embracing more of what it means to be African or decolonialized or whatever?
Well, start to question things. Like, one of the things we do is, when we show a map of the continent, we always put the south at the top. We never put the south at the bottom.
What do you mean? We always put the south at the bottom, no?
No, we always put it at the top. In the convention is to put the south at the bottom.
Yes.
But when I produce a map, I always put the south at the top.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's just a convention to put the south at the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
We are in the south, why don't we put ourselves at the top? We haven't broken that way of thinking. We're still in this convention. When I talk about writing, I think about writing. Writing, we think about it like as a talisman, as something you get to like proceed in life. You know, literacy. But then you forget that this thing is meant to be functional. It's a tool. It's not natural. It's something that humans created as a functional thing. And there's not only one way of writing. There's not only Latin alphabet, Roman alphabet, the thing we learn, es lungwini. There is other types of alphabet
There's other types of writing system, and that's the other thing we promote. We talk about the Ethiopian Ge'ez writing system. Mm. We talk about the Congolese Mandombe. We talk about Nigerian Tsibidi. We talk about Malawian Mwangwego and Isibhexe Sohlamvu.
Mm.
And these are writing systems that are indigenous, and it's a different type of literacy. That's what we're talking about when we say
decolonialism. But let me pull you back, right? I can't... The first step, the most accessible step, is not learning to write in a different language. For a guy that's starting out day one today, what would you suggest? What suggestions?
What kind of a person? From where? Who's that person?
Let's say a white person, right? A person who identifies as white, who stays in Rosebank, who
stops staying in Rosebank.
Uh-huh. Okay.
That's the first thing. Mm-hmm. You can't progress if you're staying in Rosebank. You need to go outside.
Where must you stay?
You must engage with the country.
So you're saying not residing. You mean like, you know, move around in
but
the
But not
other
only that. Mm-hmm. Look, this is the point. When I was talking about the indigenous literature of the 30s and 20s, like Umqhayi, which is very... Umqhayi is our Shakespeare, you know. He's a prolific writer. His work is so diverse and so broad. We really are killing ourselves not to study that person. Mm. And other people like BKM Thombeni, who write only in Tsonga. Mm. You know, Mapalla, who's writing only Kasesotho.
Mm.
These are very important authors we never speak about because we don't write in English. Now, that tradition was one thing, is the one literary tradition that we're forgetting. We're also forgetting about a political tradition which is called non-racialism. Non-racialism is not colorblindness. Mm. People think when you talk about that today, you're talking about being colorblind, which is, you know, it's very anti-woke. And it's problems. It's a problem because it's an excuse for whites to be fine.
Mm.
But can I tell you something? That the Freedom Charter of Ubo Mandela, Madiba, and Talibonga, and all these people... That thing is, as a Pan-Africanist, we don't agree with the Freedom Charter. Because the Freedom Charter is a multi-racialist document. It's saying that there are different races, they must live together. And that means that whites will always be on top. What Usobukwe is saying is that there are no races. That means you cannot be white in South Africa.
Mm.
And there's no South Africa, it's Azania or something else.
Mm.
In Kwekwe Gubab, we say Ngarimap. As the correct name or indigenous name for this country. And we're saying that in this country there can be no whites. All the whites must be destroyed.
Mm-hmm.
People must destroy themselves.
Yeah.
They must kill the whites.
What does that look like, Pula? You're speaking in very abstract terms. I'm trying to get like a person who's listening to that. Look,
no, but
I could go with this, but what does that mean? What does that mean? Like, practically, what does that mean?
Gavin and I are looking at each other going...
Because I think you overestimate... You think we're making people stupid, but you also overestimate people's intelligence around how do we connect. I mean, we speak about a united South Africa. That sounds simple enough, and look, we failed. So we actually, people like yourself, need to be able to simplify things so that they can be more accessible to others. So what does it mean in practical terms? Help this guy who's in Rosebank and saying, you know, what you say appeals to me, but where do I start? So you say you mustn't stay... In Rosebank, well, you're saying, what else must I...
Decentralize the things that you've taken to be normal. Decentralize those things. So what does it mean to do that? It means I don't have to look at the map this way. I can look at the map the other way. I don't have to speak this language. I can speak another language. I don't have to racialize the way you were racializing at the beginning of this conversation. I don't have to racialize a person. Mm. When I'm talking about someone and I'm saying, oh, which guy are you talking about? No, the black one. Who? Don't do that.
Mm.
Because you're killing yourself by doing that. Mm. What you're doing is you're eating people. You're a cannibal.
Mm-hmm.
You're looking at a person and you're taking something that's in your mind and you're putting it on them and you're eating them.
Mm-hmm.
That's what's happening. It's a violence. When you racialize someone,
but
it's violence.
You said that colorblindness. Is that, are you not, will somebody listening to you not say, okay, that means I shouldn't see race? Because what you said you're against colorblindness. Now, clarify that in the sense that you're not saying be colorblind and don't not see race, but you also... So what must you...
Ignorant of structural inequality that is a legacy of colonialism and apartheid. We know that there is something that is called white supremacy, and it's very powerful force in our life that's dominating our minds, eating us internally in our minds. Now, we're not saying, oh, just ignore white supremacy. and just see everybody as equal. No, people are not equal. And the fact of race is inequality. There can never be equality. Frank Wilderson III says that black is eternally slave. That's Afro-pessimism. That blackness is slaveness. It can never be anything else. There can never be a state where the black man is redeemed. There can never be a redemption or a freedom of a black man. For people to be free, the whole system has to be destroyed. Mm. Now that's the point. Now that's a big thing to say. But you have to start thinking in those utopian terms, in terms of that. There's an important Afro-pessimist theory that we're talking about here. That's Frank Wilderson III. And he's talking about that kind of thing, that the world is built on black death. And it cannot survive without black death. If there's no black death, there's no world.
Mm.
Blacks are not in the world. They're outside. It's the subaltern, as we talk about. But they cannot have a world without. You cannot have a world without the slaveness of blackness. So that's what we talk about Afro-pessimism. We don't believe in a state in Africa, a Western-style state. Forget South Africa. Don't believe in it.
So we'll call you for a show on Pan-Africanism. Mm-hmm. I want us to focus specifically on this because this is supposed to help people.
I understand. But it will help people to know these names and look up. People must read and know things for themselves.
But there's a starting point. Right?
The starting point is you desiring to change.
Let's get Gavin in on this. On where was your starting point then when you gave in to you know, I no longer identify as a white guy that's going to carry guns and do township patrols, and I'm going to fully embrace this life.
I never banged my head that, you know, we have to kill this whoever these people are.
Mm.
I never had that thought. Never.
Did you lose any friends? Did you have so-called white friends at the time? Did you lose any friends?
I think in South Africa that I always found that when I spoke to an African man, a black man in South Africa, and he said to me, "Oh, so you are Afrikaner." Because I think that's where the thing came in, the English and the Afrikaans.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And there was a huge classification that we all white, so we're all Afrikaners.
Yes.
Meanwhile, I couldn't even speak the language. I got an F at school for it. Cause, and I think that where there was always a bit of a problem with that. And then you got English schools, speaking schools, and you got Afrikaans speaking schools. White schools, if you want to call it. And that's where the whole thing, there was a bit of a... And I still today, if you see a guy... I get asked, oh, so you're Afrikaner?
Mm.
Ick. Me.
Yeah, that's all he said.
I said, me.
Just say that one word and you're good to go.
I'm thinking of the next word. I can't speak the next word. And I would say, well, I play football.
Mm.
Whoa. So you play the black man's game?
Mm-hmm.
I said, black man's game? Mm. No, I see lots of white people playing this game.
Yeah.
You know, and you know, so
what do you think? I mean, on that football point, what do you think drives the stratification of society around? You know, most white people's interaction with soccer is not black soccer, right? It's I love soccer. I watch Man United and so on. What is it that prevents?
Rory,
white
when you're saying most South Africans, what are you saying? Because it's not most South Africans are watching.
You're breaking it down, black and white.
Mm.
I think black South African men love English football.
But they don't, not to the exclusion of South
no,
African
no, no,
soccer.
No, no, no,
right?
No, but they do.
Yes.
Because of the advent of television.
Yes.
When I grew up, I didn't have a television.
But white,
we had no TV.
White men.
Can you imagine going home now with no TV, putting a wireless on?
But PSL.
You call that wireless, we should have a wireless.
But PSL is on TV as well. Why aren't we seeing white
24/7 in your face now.
Mm.
So the average South African, whatever color race now, is much more up to date with the local South African game and is watching much more now because of the event of media.
Why do you think you don't see many white faces at your soccer matches? What is it that...
Well, I find that very, very disheartening. And I really... And every time I see somebody, a friend of mine or whatever, I say, do they want to... Ah, we're going to watch it on television. What must I come? And why aren't the black men coming to the stadiums anymore? Because stadiums are not as full as it used to be. Because you must remember in the old, in the days gone by, the biggest enjoyment factor, getting away from the pass and you're not allowed to be here and all that, was going to a football match. And if you look at the stadiums in the 70s and 80s in this country, okay, 60s I don't know, but 70s and 80s, they were full, the stadiums. I mean, you know, you had 50. Now, to the derby now, you can't get... That's the only game where you get a few people.
Yeah.
But still, if you like, the Chiefs and the Pirates are not getting the same support that they used to. Because of the advent of television. People are sitting at home now. They can watch an English game and you go to the local pub or tavern or whatever you want to call it. They can watch the English game there. You can watch the local game there and you can watch a game of something else on the other screen. And I think media and social media... Modern day, what's happened modern day? People are, you can get
isn't it
updates
though,
on what's all these things now, Twitter and stuff like that. So I think if you go back, people wanted to go to the stadiums to watch a live game, but people don't have the inclination anymore, which is very sad because that affects.
Coach, you've spoken about soccer being the missed opportunity to unify this country, and you speak about the irony of trying to use rugby to unify the country. Tell us more about that.
Well, I always felt that football is played by the larger majority of Africans, South Africans, and it should be a game that should be certainly... I think the biggest problem with football is it doesn't have, let me put it this way, the development structures of the so-called rugby and the cricket. And the rugby and the cricket obviously bounced on the colonial way of doing things.
The colonial trampoline.
So... Right or wrong, I'm talking sport now, I'm talking politics. Right or wrong, it's still a good system.
Yeah.
Because they produce players. And now you'll see, if you watch the Craven Week, did you watch Craven Week this week? I mean...
Roy doesn't know what Craven Week is.
The guy, cricket, no?
But the players that are playing rugby now is...
Black
if you want to say it like that. African, South Africans. I call them South Africans.
Yeah.
And I don't see it like that.
And a lot of people from the rest of Africa have played actually as well.
Yeah, but they've got good development structures. Where football, which is the biggest and the masses, the structures, the school, there's no schools football. Development football. Organized. Craven Week. This Craven Week, why isn't there a Craven
Week?
Why don't
we have call a Craven Week of soccer?
Call it the whatever week.
Yeah.
Kaiser Matang Week. Why isn't there a week like that?
There was no Danny Craven for soccer.
Where's that man?
Yeah.
We need a Danny Craven.
We need a Danny Craven.
That guy for football, so they call it.
What about the Motsepe? The Motsepe.
Yeah, they have that cup.
Whatever,
but I'm saying, is it ongoing? Is it sustained? Through the year, is there structures? You know. So, and I think football, certainly, there's a missing.
Sure.
Like we had the World Cup here. My biggest gripe, why wasn't there a big complex built or facility built for SAFA? So we can bring out people in to coach them.
And unite, yeah.
Well, and I always say, the most important thing is to increase the skill level of South Africans. Be it in what you do. If we got more skilled people in South Africa... Literacy. I mean, I can't read. It's unlucky. plumbers, electricians, welders.
Yes.
We need skilled people in this country.
Yes.
Mandela said one thing that I'll never forget. Education. By the way, I had dinner with Mandela once. At his house. Yes. Very nice. But the thing is, if we don't educate the people in whatever skills and whatever they're doing, we got a country that's going nowhere.
Absolutely, I agree with that.
So skill labor in whatever you do, whatever
is the key,
it needs to be increased. And I'm just talking football now. We need to get more coaches. If we increase our base of coaches and skill them up to coach kids, so we're coaching, it gets bigger and bigger.
Closing thoughts on this.
Well, let me say this, following on from that. I agree very much that we need skills, but it's not only about the skills that pay. It's not the traditional skills that are all built on the oppressive system. We need different kinds of skills. We need skills that are built in indigenous knowledge, what we're calling now IKS. We need those kind of skills. We need, for instance, enterprises like these two guys. They made a business. Two boys made a business of Ukhlaba. Hlabi Nkomo, mm-hmm. for msebenzi, for all different works of people. Mm. When people have a work at home,
slaughtering.
Mm. A slaughtering business. Because these days, what we've got people living in suburbs and they want to do that stuff, but they don't know how. Mm. Mm. So they made a business because that's a skill. It's a very important skill. Mm. That kind of thinking. Mm. To like, we need skills that we can turn into progressive things that on right now,
that
we don't see that they're
recognized by the formal economy.
Well, people think, why do you need that? It doesn't pay. Mm. We need to make the way that it's going to pay. That's how you transform the thing. You need to transform using our things. Because if you stop, don't use our things. We are always a lap dog of Euro-America. We're going to beat that forever.
Because we can never beat America at being American.
You can't beat them also because they don't want. They made the system so that you can never beat them. Mm. They made that. The colonial system is about that you can never beat it.
Mm. Andrew. Let's land this thing, man.
I don't know if we can. I think this is a conversation that is rich in so many ways.
Mm.
I think I've been sitting here just listening to you guys, to be honest. Mm. But I do feel that we occupy a really interesting space because I think a lot of people who are listening to the show probably are thinking, that was a good question, Rory and Andrew, to pose, and it's clear that we've been schooled today that was probably the wrong question, you know, the wrong thought process.
I still disagree.
No, it's
I
not
the
wrong
question.
The
right question.
It's, it's that there's more questions to ask. There's a deeper level of knowledge you can begin with. You can start from a more nuanced view. You can start with something that's informed by traditions that we have access to in this country, especially those of us who have internets. Mm. So you can get these things. They are there. You can change the way you're thinking. You can think in more diverse ways. You can be lots of things. And that's what's happening today. That's why we've got such a movement in, you know, queer culture, LGBTI culture, and that, because you can be lots of things today. It's possible because the knowledge is there, the capacity is there to change the way you see things and exist in the world. You can make yourself in an honest way. That's not in a way that other people say who you are, but you can make who you are. We can make who we are, and it's not what we've been told. Because we've always been told lies, wrong things. We've always been told things about ourselves that are not how we experience things. And we need to be truer to ourselves.
And
it's about honesty.
And on that note, there's nothing more to say, my bro.
Let's just get out of here. We've got to thank our guests. Thank you so much, Pulis Kotane and Mr. Winning Coach, Gavin Hunt. Thank you so much for your time. Really appreciate it.
Let's get out of here. Jovicho.
Thanks, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thanks.
This is CliffCentral.com.